Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Hello, primates! You found Primates Tracks. Congratulations! We know that your time is a finite resource, so thank you for spending it with us. I am Josh, and I am grateful.
Hi, Josh.
That voice is Frankie, who I did not prompt. Hi, Frankie, how are you?
I'm good, Josh. Thank you.
Well, thank you for jumping in there. Today we are talking about Jilly's on Smack. We are already on track. What is this, six?
Seven.
This is track seven. Wow.
Well, six if you put Prelude to a Crawl and Hennepin Crawler together.
That's what's throwing me off.
As a single piece.
Yes, it's our sixth episode of Green Naugahyde, seventh track of the record. Got a little discombobulated there, but I'm back. And at least I'm not on Smack. So we're going to talk about that track today. Of course, we have lots of things to take care of ahead of time. So stick around, why don't you? We'll eventually talk about Jilly's on Smack. First thing I'd like to do, Frankie, is welcome a new entrant into the Punch Bowl. Of course, you too can join the Punch Bowl. All you have to do is leave a five-star review on Apple Podcast. And we've opened the door. You can leave a five-star review on Instagram and tag us or DM it to us. And I believe there's an opportunity to leave reviews on services such as Audible, if you're into that sort of thing. I feel like the demographic for Audible is, 85-year-olds who listen to books. Frankie, I don't know that we have too many Audible listeners. I know of at least one, and I'm unsure of their age. You can leave a five-star review in any way, shape, or form. Heck, tag us on Twitter. I don't care. We'll read it right here. I do have a five-star review from Apple Podcast from Unknown Person who says, love y'all. And they actually said, y'all. Yeah. Seriously, my new favorite podcast. Been binging it for days. Absolutely love y'all's analysis and perspectives on my all-time favorite band. Simple. Easy, to the point. Thank you. Thank you, Unknown Person.
Thank you very much. I always picture that this y'all contraction has something to do with the Southern accents, right?
I think that's where it came from, yes. At this point, I feel like it's universal. People who talk like me say it. And actually, every once in a while, I dip into that, and I usually use that as a way to express frustration or irritation with other people. And I say, if you hear me saying y'all, you are being really annoying. And it's usually with kids. And they pick up on that after a while. The most observant kids will say, oh, he said y'all. It's always pretty funny when that happens. So that's the Punch Bowl. And Frankie, we should welcome a couple of people back to Captain Shiner's yacht. I want to thank Jesse in California. Sorry your email languished there for a long time, buddy. I got your stickers out to you. And Anthony in New York, he requested some of the first edition of our stickers, which is the Primus Tracks logo you see on all the metadata surrounding our podcast. I suppose you could call it a classic at this point. So he added to his collection with the classic stickers. I still have a few classic stickers left, guys. And I have a bevy of the latest design, and I'm happy to mail them to you. All you have to do, DM us on Instagram, email us primustrackspod@gmail.com. That's also the PayPal email address. We're at Venmo, at Primus Tracks. Drop a few bucks our way, help support the podcast and my smack habit, and you will be greatly rewarded with stickers designed by Frankie, printed by our friends at Sticker Robot, put in an envelope, and stamped by me. Everybody's part of the team. Frankie, this time you've got lots of miscellaneous debris. Let's fire it up.
Yeah, I got some stuff, Josh. First of all, I want to welcome a new listener called Edwin. He said, just wanted to drop in and say hi. I love Primus Tracks so far, and I'm slowly making my way through it all. A little late to the game. Just finished Pork Soda, and I'm loving each episode more than the last.
Wow. Thank you, Edwin. You do have some catching up to do, and I really hope you don't get sick of this here voice right here.
I think he will be blown away when he reaches a particular track on Punch Bowl.
Oh, yes. I think he's going to be blown away when he hears the voice of Tim Soya for a whole bunch of episodes in a row, which I just, we're missing Soya around here, but he only wants to be on episodes for tracks he knows or when we're talking to somebody that he knows. The cool people, as he calls them. And boy, when Naugahyde's done, we do have a cool person for you. Thank you, Edwin. What else do we got, Frankie?
Ronaldo, who actually was the instigator of our Primus mystery of the week, the previous week.
Yeah.
It's actually the person who solved the mystery. Somebody told him that they were present at the show, and what happened was the following. Liz was about to perform something interesting, in his own words. He was building up to a special song, and then a t-shirt landed on the stage. This annoyed Liz greatly, and he said that, you know, they would omit what they were going to play, and instead they did the very low energy performance of Jerry.
Yeah.
If you hear Liz upset on stage, it most likely has something to do with objects being thrown on stage.
Yes, and I can confirm, because we received a message from our friend Daryl, who apparently attends all of the shows in which Les gets annoyed, because he helped us with that previous show. But this time we're talking about Cool House 2003 in Toronto. So this is two Toronto shows that we've talked about where something lands on stage. Les makes his comment about genitalia. This time, yeah, as you said, I was going to play something interesting, but I guess not. And then they play a listless Jerry Was a Race Car Driver. I don't know that I've ever heard a listless version of Jerry Was a Race Car Driver. And I don't know that I want to, because it would just make me sad. In the words of Daryl, Toronto crowds can be dicks. But it sounds like they were on their best behavior for the two nights at Massey Hall on the Tribute to Kings run here.
Yeah. There's one last piece of debris, Josh.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody inquired about the murders of Brandywine Theater. Can you please shed some light on this mystery?
The Murders of Brandywine Theater. Yes, I'm actually familiar with this film, not having seen it, but I do remember reading about it back in 2014 or so when the film was released. And this is a film featuring puppets, which probably means I won't watch it. No, I'm kidding. If I recall correctly, it's about a guy, a ventriloquist, whose puppet comes to life and starts speaking, and then people start dying. And the voice of the puppet, whose name is Moxie, is that of our very own Les Claypool. We haven't talked about Les in movies before. We're familiar with Pig Hunt, of course, where he's a preacher, or a deranged preacher, I suppose I should qualify that. We've got The Murders of Brandywine Theater, in which he's the voice of a puppet. Of course, the cameo in Bill and Ted. I think that's the main stuff, other than Primus videos and, of course, Electric Apricot, which we'll get to eventually. Our Les Claypool
has... we got to dip into his filmography at some point.
That's right. Our Les Claypool has... you know, he's starting to add to the credits list as far as film appearances, but he's not to be confused with Les E. Claypool III, who works in sound engineering as recently as 2012. So I should probably say worked in sound engineering. According to IMDb, he was pretty active in the 90s and aughts. His credits include, just to give you a few, sound supervisor for Cowboy Bebop the movie. A lot of video game sound, actually. Silent Hill, Resident Evil, something called Binary Domain, which I've never heard of. But this guy is a sound engineer, and quite often he would be confused with our Les E. Claypool, the musician. Les Claypool is in Primus and is doing sound design for Ninja Scrolls? Whoa! Not true. So now you know. In the words of Wikipedia, I'm happy to provide some disambiguation, Frankie. It's one of my favorite things. If you have not checked out The Murders of Brandywine Theater, I have no idea how you find it. Good luck, everybody. Whew, I'm glad we swept the deck of all that debris. It's finally clean in here. We can talk about drugs. Jilly's on smack. Track 7, Cree Naugahyde. Music by Claypool and Lalonde, as they are individually credited. Lyrics by Claypool, of course. This one checks in a little over 6.5 minutes, Frankie. We'll talk about the various parts of it.
Yes.
Squirrel, you said, was a mini epic. It's kind of interesting that we follow up with Jilly's, which one could argue is a mini epic of its own. One little piece of trivia before you get into your live history is I was checking in with Soya on some of these Naugahyde tracks, given that he was on that extensive Wonka tour. He told me that this is one that he likes from the record, and it's one that he remembers because it got a lot of play, and that's why he's not here today. But hi, Soya. How are you? All right, Frankie, live history. I know you've got some.
This is a very interesting live history, Josh. So before I get into it, just because I don't want to forget, in terms of whether this track could be a mini epic or not based on the duration, I got to confess something. If I listen to Cree Naugahyde back to back, I let the songs play in the right running order, you know, as they are on the album.
Yeah.
But I love Jilly's on Smack, so it's one of the songs from the record that I incorporate into my playlists of random Primus songs that I want to listen to. But in order to incorporate Jilly into my playlist and not feel that it's breaking the flow of the other high energy tracks that I'm listening to, I have an edited version of the song where it goes right into the riff that is previous to the drums and the upright bass coming in. So if you cut out the first part with the guitar feedback, mm-hmm. it's pretty much a conventional song in terms of duration.
Now, is this an edit you made on your own or somebody else's edit or a radio?
No,
edit?
It's something I made on my own.
Oh, okay. Because I don't recall
just for personal a radio consumption.
Eternal personal consumption.
Yes.
Of course.
Life history, Josh. Jilly's on Smack was premiered on May 19th, 2011 in Indianapolis at the Murat Theater. Very interesting thing about this venue is that when they performed there in 2011, it was a conventional show. I mean, a great show, but pretty conventional in terms of song selections. But when they returned to this particular theater a year later, they played a deep cuts night. Just to give you a couple of examples of the songs that the Murat Theater witnessed in 2012, The Return of Sathington Willoughby and Hellbound 17 and a Half.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
You can tell by live history that Jilly's on Smack is a band favorite because it has been on pretty heavy rotation since 2011 all the way up to 2022 during the current tour. Jilly is a mainstay in the set lists.
I'm looking at Toasterland here, Frankie, and I had to double check. As of this recording, I see 299 live performances, which puts it right behind Sergeant Baker, which blows my mind, and right ahead of Mr. Crinkle. Right in neighborhood with John the Fisherman and Frizzle Fry and a couple other older tracks. Now, of course, we have to take that with a grain of salt, given the lack of statistics from those earlier days. But that it's even up there on Toasterland tells me it's definitely a mainstay and has been played. As far as in the last 11 years, essentially 300 performances, a fixture on every single tour. So they must love it. Yeah. Wow.
And you know, I think even though it's been performed heavily, for me at least, it has never outworn its welcome. I think it's a very exciting song mm-hmm. to listen to live, particularly because of the breakdown. And we're going to get into that in a moment.
Mm-hmm. As we go through these Naugahyde tracks, Frankie, to me, especially when we're talking about live history and incorporating them into tours, these are still new songs to me, especially when compared to something like Seas of Cheese. I just think, oh, good, they're still playing these new tunes. This album's over a decade old, so I don't know what transpired in the last 11 years, but this is still new music to me. Did you have some quotes or interview quotes about this one?
Yes, I do. Let me share some background with you, Josh, regarding lyrical content and regarding the composition. The bass part for Jilly, as you know, was built around the arpeggio riff from Larry Lalonde. Mm-hmm. And Les has gone on record multiple times to say that he would not have written Jilly the same way if it hadn't been centered around the guitar riff. So this is another interesting case in the record where we have a song that was born out of a Lur composition.
Yeah. I remember I remember an interview in which he said, I'm not going to write a song and say, come on, fellas, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then play a bunch of whole notes. So it's kind of funny to hear that. Yes, they definitely structured this around Larry's main part there, for sure.
All right. I have a couple of quotes for you, Josh. I knew Lur and this cachet of riffs he was always reluctant to bring in. I was like, Lur, you got to bring that stuff in. Bring in some stuff. And so he did. And I told Jayski, look, come up with some beats. So to build off someone else's stuff is always exciting. That was what was so exciting about Oysterhead. Trey would come in with stuff. Stuart would come in with stuff. And then there was the stuff we came up together. It puts you in a different space. I wouldn't have come up with the bass part on Jilly's on Smack if I wrote the song. Mm-hmm. That song is based on Lur's part because my natural inclination isn't to sit there and play whole notes if I'm writing.
That's the
because
one,
I'm thinking in I'm thinking in rhythms and whatnot. But here was the foundation, and I was there supporting what he was doing. It's an exciting place to start, and I think it really helps the record a lot. And another interesting thing, Josh, is that a few weeks ago on the Primus Tracks Facebook page, I shared 10 tips for aspiring bass players.
Oh, right.
On tip number 6, Les actually name checks Gillesome Smack. It goes as following. Tip number 6, be open-minded in your playing, but above all else, serve the song. For many years, Primus songs started with the bass part or the vocal part. But on the Green Nogahide record, I was insistent that the guys brought in songs or beats that could be built into songs. So a song called Gillesome Smack was built around a guitar part. If you listen to the bass, it's very different to, say, The Last Salmon Man or the other songs on the record that started with the bass. What do you think, Josh?
I think that, one, that shows a lot of maturity, of course, as a musician on his part to play a support role. And we see that a lot, especially in his guest turns on records like Desert Sessions, Tom Waits' Real Gone. And those are the two that jump out at me at any rate, where he's playing a support role. And if you didn't see bass by Les Claypool in the liner notes, you might not even know it's him. And obviously we know it's him in this one for a variety of reasons, but there's some standard Claypoolian things happening on the upright. But that he is thinking that way shows his openness as a musician to the ideas of others, but also the trust in those guys. And he's played with these guys for years at this point. So yeah, he should trust them to bring something in to build a foundation off of and not one-up them, steal the spotlight, that sort of thing. I'm thinking of Aaron on the Side of Caution as well, which he's already said that was a Lur thing. You know, he knows when to be showy. He knows when to dial it back. He knows when to stick with the groove. He knows when to bring some fancy pants riff in there. So
that's right.
He's an all-around musician. He knows what he's doing.
In terms of lyrics, Josh, I have a couple of quotes for you because they built the song around the guitar part, and then it was time to write the lyrics. And Les said, digging through my little notepad, I found the phrase, Gillesome Smack, and she won't be coming back from the holidays. And I sort of expanded on that. It's someone based on a friend of ours that disappeared into the world of heroin. And every now and again, she pops her head up, and we see how she's doing. But I wanted to write from the perspective of friends and family. Gillesome Smack, she won't be coming back. You know, what's grandma thinking about Gilly not being there? Does she know where she is? And just the notion of how addiction affects the family. And Les was also quoted as saying that the holidays are a particular time of the year that can be very difficult for families with missing persons because they are staring at an empty spot on the dinner table or they are staring at an empty sock hanging from the chimney.
Yeah. I'm going to call that a universal pain. And what I mean by that is a lot of people can empathize with that and it hits home. These are depressing lyrics, but at the same time, a lot of people can bond with them because it's unfortunately not an uncommon experience for a lot of families. And I wanted to ask you, Frankie, have you seen the film The Panic in Needle Park?
No, I haven't. Please tell me about it.
So that was, I want to say, 1971, and that was actually Al Pacino's first leading role in a film.
Wow.
And I draw parallels to that in the sense that this nice young lady hooks up with a small-time dealer and heroin user. She gets hooked, and it's all downhill from there. She disappears from her family. She's in what they call Needle Park, which is based on a neighborhood in New York City in the late 60s, early 70s. She's just stuck in that life now. The idea of looking at it from the family dynamic, as Les does here, I don't believe happens in the film. It's been years since I saw it. But I always drew parallels to that because I always thought, what's her family thinking? Where is her family? And are they trying to find her? Are they staring at an empty chair? Do they care?
You're totally right, Josh. It actually reminds me of a really heartbreaking interview I saw with Richie Edwards' sister, Richie from Manic Street Preachers. And she said that no matter how many years have passed, every time the phone rings or every time somebody knocks at the door, her heart starts racing and she springs out of her seat and rushes to answer because somewhere in the back of her mind, she still believes that one day her brother is going to be at the door, or she's going to listen to his voice at the other end of the line. It's really tragic.
And once again, that's something this has affected thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, millions of families around the world at this point. I'm lucky enough that that hasn't affected my family in this way. So I can't completely understand it, but just the fact that it's so prevalent now, I feel like I can. So Les really hit on something here, and it certainly has impacted his life. We know that with the stories he's told about friends and family over the years. So pretty heavy. And the music, once again, you know, we had another track on this record with bouncy music and kind of a doomsday message and tragedies a-coming. And in this one, we get some bouncy music and another doom and gloom story here. So there's kind of a theme emerging, I think. I mean, he was really reaching for some dark stuff on this record.
Another character in a line of tragic figures in the Primus catalog.
If you want to talk about lyrics now, why not? He does a really effective job of taking what could just be surface lyrics, and when we read the lyrics just straight through, it kind of feels like it's surface, but it is contained to these characters, and there's some very, to borrow a Frankie term, evocative lines. You know, not everything needs to be, whether it's song lyrics or a film, needs to be some kind of socioeconomic deconstruction of, why are these people doing drugs? Why did they turn there in the first place? What were the societal pressures? The blah, 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 blah. That doesn't matter. In this case, this is the wreckage of their lives. And in the case of Jilly's on Smack, it's the effect it has on the family. Staring at the empty chair.
Absolutely.
And so on.
Right? Absolutely, Josh. Yeah. I agree with you completely.
So it's like the survivors thing. How do the survivors deal with blank, whatever it is, suicide, drug addiction, a missing person, somebody that just left their life? The family POV in Jilly's is somewhat chilling. She doesn't come home anymore. She's a nice girl. You see it in the lyrics. I'm going to point to my favorite couplet, though, Frankie, because it's economy of words, and it's enough to where you can fill in the imagery and the feelings and the emotions. Jilly always phoned her mother, emailed daily to her brother, till she took a junkie lover and began to fade. There's a couple of things going on there. First of all, those four phrases. We know she's dedicated to her family, but she gets in a relationship with this person. The begin to fade part is, you know, to borrow your term again, heartbreaking, because you can see people fading away, whether it's dying of an illness or, you know, going into the throes of addiction. So we're seeing that there. And I can fill in the imagery and the emotion, the emotional state of the family there. So to me, that's a really important pair of lines there. And just from a rhythmic standpoint, the cadence at which Les is delivering it, I love this because it's very staccato. Jilly always phoned her mother, emailed daily to her brother, till she took a junkie lover and began to fade. So we get three staccato phrases, and then the began to fade is more legato and smooth.
And we even get some scatting on the breakdown, right?
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, that began to fade. The began to fade really puts the emphasis on the drug addiction. And then we get into that scat singing, which is one of my favorite Les Claypool hallmarks. I know I've said it more than once on this pure podcast. When he gets to scat singing, it's a grand old time. And I feel like just doing a jig. And I'm kind of doing one right now. I apologize, Frankie. You're seeing me on camera dancing. It's not good. Yes, the scat singing, I will point to that. That's one of my favorite Les things. It's a lot of fun. And I definitely want to play that part. It's a dance number, right? This is about drug addiction, but it's a dance number. The hell were they thinking? It's a great one. And this is one I think is probably a favorite, an album favorite, at least for a lot of people, because when this one shows up on set lists, nobody really complains. I think a lot of people are happy to get this one.
Yeah, totally.
Now, we were actually going to have our good pal Johnny Grisoskis from Les Special for this episode, but he, as well as Rory and Luke, just spent the week traveling to and from summer camp in Illinois, and they performed and sat in, I would say, a ludicrous number of sets, Frankie. So including playing 2 hours of Primus from about 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. And if you see the video over there at Les Special on the socials, my God, did they have a good crowd. And those people were into it. I should say the drummer from Umphrey's McGee jumped on stage and played drums on their cover of Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, which was pretty awesome.
Really?
Yeah, and he sounded great. kind of kicked Rory off the kit, it sounds like, and Rory was absolutely okay with it.
Oh, yes. I recall now. I watched the clip on Instagram. Luke was on fire during that performance.
Oh, yes. And I'm sure his tendons were afterwards, too. And then they went and played a special set. They sat in with all these different acts, and it looks like they had a blast. So Johnny Message,
they're mixing it up. They're doing pretty cool sets.
Dude, La Special, you guys are killing it right now. So Johnny's exhausted. And what he's going to do...
Understandably
indeed. So he's going to record his analysis and a playthrough of a sort for Jilly's on Smack. And I'm going to drop it in right here so we can hear what he has to say. Dude.
Just want to say, Josh and Frankie, huge fan of the show. Thanks so much for having me back on. Jilly's is one of my favorite Primus songs. And as many of you out there know, this song started with Larry. I believe the story goes they were recording Green Naugahyde and Les sort of said, "Hey, Larry, you got any ideas up your sleeve?" And he brought this riff to the table. Really cool guitar riff, which utilizes delay, which is an echo effect very commonly used. And the way Larry uses it here in an extremely rhythmic way is really cool. And the first recorded example of a rhythmic delay pattern that I can think of is One of These Days by Pink Floyd. If you listen to the very beginning, you hear a bass note and it sort of echoes out. And after a few echoes, Roger starts plucking it in a very certain way at a very specific time to get this sort of rhythmic effect. You're sort of playing to the speed of the echo to get this sort of cascading effect, or sheets of sound, as I sometimes call it. It makes it sound like you're playing more notes than you are, and they fit together in a really cool rhythmic way. And in Jilly's, it makes a really cool groove against what Jane Lane is doing and what Les is doing. Other examples of rhythmic delay could be Streets Have No Name by U2. Edge, in general, uses a lot of rhythmic delay tricks. Interesting to note that because Larry brought this riff to the table, Les plays something pretty unusual for Les Claypool, bass style. I believe I read an interview somewhere where he said something along the lines of, I would never have thought to play just simple sustained whole notes on my upright bass. You know, I never would have written a song like that, but it just fit well with what Larry was already doing. And if you listen to Les's part, it's just these long bowed whole notes, which means you're holding the note for an entire four beats, sustaining. Once the vocals come in, he goes to half notes and he plays them twice as fast, but they're still long notes, long, simple held tones, which is pretty unusual, you know, compared to Tommy the Cat or Nut Butter or something like that. So it's pretty cool that because of what Larry brought to the table, it sort of affected what Les played to serve the song. So let's take a listen to the guitar riff that we all know and love. And then I'm going to show you it without delay so you can see how much the echo effect is adding to the overall rhythm and groove of this guitar part. Here it is with delay, just as we know it from the record. And turn that delay pedal off. Let's turn the delay pedal back on. That's better. So you can see what Larry is actually playing is quite simple and quite minimal. But the way he's playing with the echo effect in time, it just really enhances it and makes this really cool rhythmic pattern. This is called dotted eighth note delay. A dotted eighth note is worth 3/16th notes. 16th note is simply 1e and a 2e and a 3e and a 4e and a. But dotted eighth note is going to be three of those. So it's going to sound like this. Da, 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 da. You can think of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So when he hits a note, it echoes da, 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 da. So if he plays do, 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 he's going to get do, 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 kind of thing. So again, using the delay to enhance, add more notes that fit and weave in the rhythm. I believe he's using his MXR carbon copy delay pedal, which is impressive because this pedal does not have tap tempo. Tap tempo is a feature that many people use to tap their foot to the beat to get the delay to do what they want to in rhythm. Here, much like One of These Days by Pink Floyd, the band simply starts the song with the delay effect, so they sort of use that as their guide for the tempo and then follow that. That's probably a big part of why Larry starts the song, because it all depends where his knobs are set, and that's going to be the timing of the delay. If you've watched Larry's rig rundown, you can see that he has little markings on his knob that help him remember where to set it every night, so it's usually about the same exact tempo. Larry also opens the song with a wall of noise. It's just a big F chord played with what sounds like modulation of some kind, maybe phaser or flanger, and a lot of tremolo, which is volume fluctuation, to give it this sort of seasick vibe. And he does that big wall of F noise, and he cuts it just at the same time that he starts the riff, which is pretty cool. And then that riff goes for a little bit. The band gets their bearings rhythmically. Jay comes in with that cool fill, and we're off running. It's also worth noting that Larry is playing F, B, D, and G sharp, which are sort of in a diminished arpeggio, which we know Larry loves to use quite a bit. If you think of Mr. Know-It-All, Rapscallion, the South Park theme, the solo on Shake Hands with Beef, Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, his upbeat skanks on Lacquerhead, and the heavy part in Pudding Time are just a few examples of how much Larry loves the flatted fifth, which guitarists, if you take a power chord and slide the top note half step down, you'll be in tritone town. Les follows the same scale with his whole notes, sustaining notes that are in that scale, which are all a flat third apart, a minor third apart, which is 3 frets on the guitar or bass. If you play a note, you go up 3 frets, go up 3 more, go up 3 more. You'll recognize that tonality being used in quite a few Primus songs. Great song. Love the lyrics. They harken back to a lot of Les's early lyrics and commentary, similar to maybe Lacquerhead, Damn Blue Collared Tweakers, Herald of the Rocks might be another example, tales of people who've been sort of swallowed by addiction. So cool, common thoroughfare lyric material from Les, a great groove from one of our favorites, Mr. Jay Lane, and one of the coolest guitar parts on any Primus record, in my opinion.
Wow, Johnny, you are a genius. Full disclosure, I haven't heard what he said yet. I really enjoy what Larry's doing here. He's got a lot of layered effects to build that lick. And it's kind of neat because that main lick I'm talking about, because that deconstruction that you so callously edited out of your own version of this, Frankie, is kind of like a deconstructed version of the riff in a way. And he's got some really cool effects going on. But it is over a minute. I didn't realize it was 16, 17% of the track at this point. Of that intro, and then he gets into the main lick, and he's got some kind of harnessed echo on. I don't know, Johnny will tell us, or Johnny already has told us. Is that how that works? What the effects are? So he's, but Larry's got this thing where it's filling the space. He's not actually playing all those notes. Sounds like it'd be really difficult to anyway. But he's got the echo on, so he's just playing one iteration of each note. And the effects are filling in for him. To me, when I hear that guitar lick, and then there's one little lick after the breakdown, I think King Crimson. Are you hearing that in there at all?
Pretty much. I agree with your assessment, Josh. And I think, even though, you know, it's curious, because even though the upright part could be considered relatively simple for Les Claypool standards, you know, because, I mean, the main riff is... it's pretty simple, right? It's very straightforward, but it works great because it doesn't overshadow the other two instruments. Larry's doing something very complex with the guitar. He's all over the place. And Jay is also playing a very complicated drum part, at least to my ears. And then in the breakdown, you get to hear how, you know, how complicated the song truly is because of the way that they change tempo and the way that they isolate some of the parts of the song. And, you know, when while Les is doing that muted part on the upright, and the other instruments, you know, like Jay is doing that thing with the toms, right? And then when they return to the main riffs after the breakdown, it's really amazing to hear again the complexity of the main part. But the way that they return to it, it's not just like a stop and start thing like they usual like they do in other occasions. This is a very interesting breakdown because it's like the breakdown itself breaks down in order to return to the main riff. It's really fascinating, and it's a very enjoyable part to listen to.
Yeah, it does sound like it would be a train wreck on that transition from the breakdown back to the main lick, but it's calculated and it sounds messy, but that's purposeful. I really appreciate the contrast you are drawing between the main lick and the breakdown. There's a couple of things I definitely want to point out there. So let's listen to our main lick. That part right there, great representation of the main lick. That second part of breakdown, which I think we've used the word tribal before on certain tribal sounding things, but to me, this really has that tribal sound too. Let's contrast the part we just heard with our breakdown here, with particular emphasis on what Les is doing, because he's playing those whole notes under Larry's main lick, playing a nice harmony, and then we get percussive Les Claypool. So he's still using the bow, but he's just beaten on the strings now, and we're getting percussive Les Claypool right about here. Rad. Pause. That right there is my favorite fill in the whole thing. Ding dong. Love it. And there's your scat singing, Frankie. And that's Les Claypool right there, right? Hitting those percussive low notes and then giving us some of that stuff above the nut there or on the highest end of the strings on the upright. So it's quite a contrast there with the bass. Larry's providing, and that part, this is definitely the Les part, right? Because this is credited to Claypool alone. So this is the Claypool part. So Larry's back to providing texture, and he does a wonderful job. But then we get a third part there after this, where it goes to halftime, and we get a more resonant sound from everybody involved. There it is. Back to that. And return to the halftime. Are you hearing the fluff beater on the second kick drum, Frankie, that Gino revealed to us and Rory explained?
Yes, totally.
Yeah, we're getting that huge resonant kick that just deepens things there. So we're hearing it here too, and that really just opens up the soundscape for this next part. So we have contrast here, and it's fascinating. This is really the most compelling part of the music to me.
I also want to point out, Josh, that listening to this section, I was reminded about the fact that Lur's guitar part sounds remarkably similar to the fast solo of the last superpower, aka Rapscallion. Are you hearing it?
Maybe with the effects. I don't know that I'm hearing the same run on notes.
No, I mean, not the same run, but yes, a similar sound.
Yes, I think the sound he achieves is fairly similar. So I can see why you're drawing parallels there. I don't know if you've seen Lur's pedal board, but to put it in terms you'll understand, Frankie, it takes about 6 camels to pull that entire thing from show to show. Okay? Dromedary camels, right?
Yes.
Thank you. I knew I could count on you for that one. So then we get the transition, and this is the transition that sounds like a wreck because we go back to the halftime. And for the transition part, I think if you listen to Larry's guitar, you're going to be able to follow the entire thing. And this is where he goes full crimson to me. Actually, the whole band kind of goes full crimson for me here. That is one of the cooler Primus moments on this record. So if you follow Lur's guitar line, I can't even articulate it, but if you follow Lur's line there, you can kind of see the path that they're taking. take what sounds like a total wreck, but it makes sense to me. And that's why I'm calling it Full Crimson, because I'm a Crimson fan, but a lot of it sounds like wreckage, but it makes sense. you actually have to be able to dig through it to make sense of it sometimes. A lot of fun there. My gosh, they have three compelling parts, and I can see why this is a live favorite and just a general favorite of those who have the record.
Ever since I watched the trailer for Greenout High, do you remember that trailer?
Right, yes, with the footage of the toy bike and
that's right.
Some ambient
highlighting
footage.
A few tracks from the album. Yeah. Jilly sounded absolutely killer from the get-go.
Ah, yes, Jilly was part of it. I don't remember all the other tracks, but I do remember some of that footage and being mystified. They did a great job teasing the record, I remember. That's a great call.
Yes.
I haven't thought about that teaser video in ages.
We also have to consider another important thing about this song, Josh. There was a time when only singles got music videos. Now,
oh, right.
Yes, Jilly was not a single in the strict sense because it was not released physically on its own. It was not promoted as Jilly's on Smack, the brand new Primus single. I mean, it didn't receive that kind of push, but
yeah.
There was a music video commissioned for the track, and it came pretty late in terms of the record promotion. I mean, Naugahyde had been out for a while when this video premiered, and it's interesting because it harks back to what we saw on videos like DMV, where the band chose to use a collection of live footage to go along with the track. And on DMV, it was pretty fun. On Jilly, sometimes I think it was a bit strange because you see footage of Les playing four-string bass, and it's kind of strange to see that footage paired up with Jilly's on Smack. But they did interpolate some footage of, you know, of families having, well, spending time together during the holidays, and that matches the vibe of the song pretty well. So I think right. It's a welcome addition to the Primus videography, but yeah. It's not a favorite video of mine by any stretch.
It's certainly not one I have viewed in quite some time. A couple of things I recall from it mostly are those home video or home film footage pieces of people celebrating the holidays. But the other thing I remember is, was this not created by Stuart Copeland's son? I do believe it was Stuart Copeland's son who made the video. And I don't know if Primus paid him to do it or he came to him and said, I want to make a video for it. That I believe that it came through Stu and his
son.
That's
pretty cool.
So there's a connection there. And that's part of the, I guess that's probably part of the reason the video came to be. And I'm sure it was done cheaply in the Primus sense. But can you tell me, Frankie, was this the second video? Because we have videos, of course, for Tragedy, this track, and Lee Van Cleef. And I don't remember which came
Hoenn
first.
For the Man was the other one.
Oh, and Hoenn. Yeah, we have four videos from this one.
Came about from a competition. We'll get into that when we reach the track.
Do you remember the order of the videos?
If I'm not mistaken, it was probably Tragedy, Lee Van Cleef,
okay,
Jilly, and perhaps Hoenn was the last one.
Okay.
Or could be the other way. Maybe Jilly was the last one, but I'm inclined to think that Hoenn for the Man was the last video from the album, right?
We'll have to do some digging and report back next episode because I don't remember. It's out there on the internet. We'll get 1,000 emails about it.
I certainly remember reading about the premiere of the video in Rolling Stone, and I remember that the first thought that came to my mind was, wow, are they still promoting the album? I mean, it was a strange feeling. So I'm sure Jilly came on pretty late in terms of promotion.
Yeah, I think you're right. We'll find out next time with all our miscellaneous debris. okay, so the last thing I want to talk about briefly is the vocal delivery. Now, one of our dedicated listeners prior to us recording this said, hey, Les has a very Residents-like vocal delivery here, and I never really heard that before, so in his vocal delivery. But I'm going to play portion of the first verse here, Frankie. You tell me, do you hear a Residents-like delivery in the first verse? I will say it's very breathy and a little loose with the delivery, and with the couple that with the vocal processing, it does give the vocals kind of a floaty quality, and I suppose I see where this guy's coming with it? You tell me.
I guess you could associate it with later day residents. Perhaps, you know, something like the shows that we were discussing with Elizabeth Gore. Mm-hmm. But for me, you know, I'm not a huge fan. I like their music, but I'm not an expert. So for me, it's not usual to associate the Residents with that vocal delivery. I'm thinking more about, you know, the nasal tone of Constantinople.
Right. So if we go into, I suppose if we go into the Jilly's on Smack chorus near the end, maybe that's what he's referring to. But here, just that first couplet is so unusual for Les, at least, as far as vocal delivery, because it is so low register and breathy. Jilly's on Smack. And it is kind of creepy. So that's what I thought our listener was talking about as far as a resonance quality to the vocals there. But it's so unusual for Les. I remember being a bit disarmed by the vocal delivery. But then, of course, later in the track, we get more of a standard Les Claypool voice. Let's see if I can find one. That's Les. Shoot, I forgot how great that ending was, too. And then that Lur's lick fades on out. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm hearing resonance quality, but I do hear him being creative with his vocal delivery in that first couplet, and then just going back to being regular Les Claypool as far as his vocals. Any last thoughts? I mean, before we get into the live cuts, overall, I really like this track. And sometimes when I really like something, I don't have a lot to say about it.
I would say it's an extremely enjoyable song, not only in the context of the record, but it's a welcome addition to the Primus catalog in general. It's a really fun song. It's the classic Claypool duality of a tragic character paired with very catchy music.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not commercial or a single in the strict sense of the word. But in terms of Primus, I think it's pretty catchy. I think it's one of the most accessible songs on the album, for sure. And that's surprising, considering it's an upright tune. And with Primus, those can go either way. You know, they can be very catchy like Mr. Crinkle, or they can be very obscure and very hardcore like Glass Sandwich. So I think Jilly's on Smack manages to find a perfect balance between being accessible, but maintaining the essence of Primus, being simple, but also complex at the same time, and, you know, just overall being a song that serves the story's telling pretty well.
I disagree with everything. No, well put. Well put. Well put. Let's talk live tracks. Our first one is NPR World Cafe. I remember this performance. Looks like we're going to look at the intro and one of the main verses. So let's hear the sound quality on good old NPR's World Cafe. Only a 30-second intro on World Cafe. It's interesting that guitar effect is not as prevalent, so you can hear the single notes that Larry's picking. As far as the note articulation and then where the effect picks up. But that's a really nice sound and performance so far.
Jilly's on Smack, and she won't be coming back.
Low register.
She won't be coming back. For the holidays, Jilly had a smile, spanned over a mile. She left them standing in the aisles. Her mother emailed daily to her brother.
little more theatrics there on that one. Plus, it's on a radio show, so you get a really nice studio quality as far as the live in studio, I should say, for the recording. That is still available through the NPR website. I've dialed it up here and there. They keep everything up in perpetuity, essentially. So if you search for NPR World Cafe Primus, you'll find this one. I think you'll also find Claypool Lennon Delirium. I believe they made it onto World Cafe at some point.
They did, yes. And Les Claypool solo, too. He did a fantastic session for Wales and Woe.
Oh, that's right. Yes, indeed. Wow, they love him over at World Cafe. How has he not done a Tiny Desk concert yet? Come on, Tiny Desk concerts. Looks like our next one is from the Naugahyde bonus track. So this is that vinyl release.
Brilliant release, yes.
Oh, the one you called a disgrace for not being released as an entire live performance.
Yes, because these recordings are fantastic, not just for the quality, but for the performance itself. It's really, really superb.
Let's give it a listen. Crowd loves it. We're gonna get to the. I think we'll get to some scat singing here, right? Oh, and this is where we're listening for something that sounds like the mini solo in Rapscallion, according to you.
That's right.
All right, here we go.
Scallion vibes, right?
I hear it there. I don't really hear it on the studio version, which is funny, but I do hear it there. I think he's using a similar effect setup. Wow, good ear, Frankie. I don't think I would have pulled that from there.
Thank you.
Great scat singing, too, but he's really low register. Almost sounds like he's doing Morse code. Our next performance is Los Angeles at the Orpheum in 2015, so we are into Tim Alexander territory here.
Yes, I believe it's the final performance ever of the Chocolate Factory album in its entirety. It's got that very, very perfect surgical sound that they achieved during that tour.
Nice and creepy. I think if Primus did an ambient album of whale sounds, I would buy it.
They actually did that a few more times other than this show. And, you know, this was prior to the Desaturating 7 being released. And for that period of time between these shows and the album coming out, I always wondered if they were going to use that for something, because it wasn't isolated. It's something that they did on a few occasions. You never know. It might turn up on a record at some point in the future, right?
Well, if Les is going to mine the Ancient Mariner for conspiranoia material, anything's possible. We might hear this in a few years down the road. Looks like our last live cut is from Papillion, Nebraska. A very classy name for a location in Nebraska, I have to say. Frankie, if you never had the pleasure of driving Interstate 80 in Nebraska, I highly recommend that you don't. It's 400 miles and nothing. Don't do it unless you have every episode of Primus Tracks queued in your podcast player. Otherwise, you'll go insane. So, Papillion, Nebraska, 2015. Looks like we're getting the drum break deconstruction leading to Coda from Frankie's notes. And that is super descriptive. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. So in that live setting, when you hear this live recording, you can hear the sense that it makes. If you're following Larry, you can hear how the drums, as far as Tim's performance, is following Larry. It works. Great choices, as always, Frankie. I always get something out of these recordings. And once again, to the audience, I am not somebody that listens to a lot of live recordings. I don't even go back to those '03, '04 soundboards very much. Thank you for broadening my horizons, Frankie.
Really pleased you enjoyed the live cuts. It's one of my favorite parts of the show.
Mine too, because I don't have to do any work except press play. So, Jilly's on smack. Ugh, let's go dry out and rehab, because you've been tracked. Next time, Frankie, let's get a kick out of watching Clint.
I still get a kick out of Clint, but I do have a question, Josh. Whatever happened to Lee Van Cleef?
Tune in next week to find out. Only on Primus Tracks.
And I gotta say, Josh, I'm not one to tease this kind of things live, but this time I will make an exception, and I want to tell our listeners that we have somebody very special in store for Lee Van Cleef.
Oh, yeah.
He was dying to be on. We love him. He's an amazing guy. So it was long overdue.
See if you can guess who's going to join us for Lee Van Cleef. And it's not Clint Eastwood, and it's definitely not Lee Van Cleef. We'll eliminate those two. That's all I've got. At Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter, PrimusTracksPod@gmail.com. Write us, why don't you?
Yes, buy stickers.
Yes, feed the eternal consumption engine. Later days.
Willie Mays.